In some respects, the Bible is an exercise in understanding various levels of consciousness. Human consciousness, divine consciousness, even the consciousness of the world and of natural reality. In our first session together, we talked about mything the point, which is really what the book of Genesis, at least in its earliest chapters, is all about, and the awakening of human consciousness as part of a pilgrimage. In our second session together, we talked about the development of consciousness of community, the fact that a person cannot survive in any effective, meaningful, or even human way without being part of some kind of larger community. You can't be atomistic in the kind of world in which we live. There is this need for a community consciousness. And this was part of the story of particularly the book of Exodus in the Hebrew Scriptures. This hour we're going to talk about consciousness and memory, particularly historical memory as storytelling. And in doing so, we're talking about an anecdote and the allegory of antiquity in which this sense of consciousness of our past and how that informs us and from which development takes place in our own consciousness of our own time. Now, we've dealt with Exodus, and to go through the biblical books one by one very, very quickly to take us out of Torah and into the more historical materials in the more classic sense of that definition is to cover the rest of the Torah very, very quickly. Genesis, Exodus, we've discussed in detail. We come then to Leviticus. In Leviticus, we have the laws concerning sacrifices, the ceremony for the consecration of priests, laws about ritual purity, which became so important to the Jewish people then and to this very day, laws concerning holiness, vows, and tithes. There's almost no narrative in Leviticus. It's a priest's manual. The priests are confused because there are several lineal succession of priestly type leaders, and under the limited amount of time we're dealing with here, it's very difficult to go into these differences between the Aaronites, the Mushites, the Levites, and so forth. But it is important to recognize that patterns about purity and the sacrificial system are detailed here in the book of Leviticus. Also, there's no doubt that, for example, the great Abraham story of him about to sacrifice his own son, which has been a very difficult part of Scripture for everyone to deal with, though he doesn't sacrifice his son, reflects what was the case in the Middle East. There was child sacrifice going on everywhere, and throughout much of the early pages of the biblical narrative, there are references, dozens of references, to child sacrifice in one form or another. Most of these references abhor the practice of child sacrifice, but suggest peripherally that it must have been occurring even amongst some of the Hebrew peoples, though hardly as an official policy. So we have coming out of this period a consciousness not only of their own past history, but of the surrounding cultures. And purity was very, very important to them. You really need to read the book of Leviticus. One must do so for himself or herself to come to some understanding of why purity was so important, not only to the ancient Hebrew peoples, but to Jewish peoples, many of which still practice that kind of purity today. The next book in the Hebrew Scriptures is Numbers, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. It's about the organization of Israel at Sinai for their wilderness journeyings, and it's about God disciplining them in those wilderness journeyings, and it's about experiences they had on the plains of Moab. These are miscellaneous experiences. What shapes this story is the numbering of the people, but also the 40 years. And as we suggested earlier, 40 has become, as a result of this particular period in the Jewish history, a symbolic number that will penetrate the life of the Hebrew peoples and even the Christian peoples ever thereafter. 40 becomes a symbol of being born again. It becomes a symbol of being renewed. It becomes a symbol of retreat in order to go back into life more vigorously. And so you have the 40 days of the flood. You have the 40 years of wilderness wanderings. You have the 40 days in the cave by Elijah, which we'll allude to briefly in this particular session, right down to the time of Jesus when presumably he goes out to be tempted in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. It's a symbol for rebirth, for regeneration, for new directions, and so forth. The book of Numbers tells us that there were 600,000 men, therefore perhaps 2 to 3 million people in journeys. Obviously, this cannot be an historical remembrance, but it's a way of saying we were a great nation right from the beginning. And the story in Numbers is about frustration, rebelliousness, rashness, rivalry, and about God's patience and impatience with these people who were now being called God's peculiar people. The last of the five books of the Torah is Deuteronomy. This is a book that was probably composed at the same time, many years after the event, probably during the time of Josiah. Josiah was a king who came along, and in about the year 622, you can read about this in 2 Kings, the 22nd and 23rd chapters. But this is a story about a great, great king. Josiah is generally viewed, along with David, as one of the two great kings in the history of Israel, or the history of the Hebrew peoples is the proper way to say it at this point. Josiah brought about a great reformation after a period of dreadful deterioration in the national life of the Jewish or the Hebrew peoples, and much more important from his point of view, drastic deterioration in the religious, ceremonial, purity-practicing life of the Hebrew peoples. In the book of Deuteronomy, therefore, we're presumably listening to the voice of Moses, though it must have been written in the 7th century before this common era, and is the voice of someone else speaking through the name of Moses, in which the emphasis is that God, Yahweh, is the Lord of nations and history. The people are chosen for the sake of the world. The Hebrew people are chosen not for their own sake, but for the sake of the world, that they are to have exclusive loyalty to Yahweh, no other gods before me. There is still the element of henotheism in this, though we're coming toward monotheism, no doubt. And then finally, the concept of covenant becomes predominant here in the book of Deuteronomy. There's an absolute mutuality of obligations. God has obligations and can be held to account just as we have obligations as his people, the chosen people, and can be held to account. So much for the wrapping up of the Torah in far too rapid a period of time. You must read it for yourself. We go to Joshua and to Judges, two books that must be seen as twins in a certain respect of one another, because most scholars take the point of view that they are talking about the very same time period, but tell the story in a very differing way. In Joshua, the word Joshua means Yahweh is salvation, and this was to become, many centuries later, the name of Jesus. Jesus being the Greek form of the Hebrew word Joshua. And Joshua tells the story of the conquest of the land of Canaan, the so-called promised land, though already occupied by the Canaanites and some other peoples, how the land was divided amongst the tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel, Israel being the name of Abraham's grandson Jacob. Jacob's name is changed to Israel. So whenever you use the name Israel, you're talking about a man. And instructions of Joshua to his people in the last two chapters, or three or four chapters, last two chapters of the book of Joshua. And the story of Joshua says that after the people had gone through their 40 years of wilderness wanderings, and Moses had died and been buried at a location that nobody could ever find because they weren't meant to find it in order not to idolize Moses or idolize a piece of land, that a sweeping conquest of Canaan took place. That's the description you find in Joshua. In point of fact, no such thing probably ever occurred in that way. It was not a sweeping conquest of Canaan, but a very piecemeal affair in which one tribe took over one portion of land that it hadn't had before, another took over another, gradually and sometimes going forward, sometimes going back in terms of conquering the so-called promised land or holy land. But Joshua pictures it not as being piecemeal at all, but as one great, sweeping, heroic military conquest. It does, however, the book of Joshua, however inaccurate it may be in that historical sense, it does illustrate powerfully the enormous cultural conflict that was occasioned by occupying the so-called promised land, the abhorrence of other gods than their own, the fact that they were beginning to say, don't intermarry with foreigners. That will come up later in the period of Ezra and Nehemiah far more forcefully, but already it's begun. Intermarriage is somehow wrong, morally wrong. And the notion of the complete destruction of forbidden possessions like foreign gods or their artistry and artwork of a religious sort. It reminds one that all throughout the Bible there is this marked abhorrence of idolatry, particularly as it is fashioned out of physical things. This is really such a predominant theme within various parts of the Bible as to need some kind of comment. Because the fact is, that kind of idolatry, that is, idolatry of images, of physical representations, and so forth, is really part of the religious quest. Because the sacred, it seems to me, and this now is a theological comment, not just a biblical comment, though it represents some strains of the biblical tradition, idolatry is part of the religious quest because the sacred never manifests itself to humanity directly, but always through something other, in myths, objects, buildings, people, human ideas, doctrines. They may be true or they may be false, they may be right or they may be wrong, but our experience of the divine is always carried through symbolic representations. Always carried through symbolic representations. As many would choose to say, God is like the sun. If you look at the world washed in the presence of God, you see the world more clearly. If you turn and look directly at the sun, you go blind. And if you look directly at God, you go blind. And by the way, that is a biblical tradition. All throughout the Bible is the notion you cannot see God and live. All throughout the Bible, there is this notion that to see God is so dangerous as that it brings about death. Well, at least blindness. And that's why when we talk about idolatry in myths or objects or buildings or people or human ideas, we're really dealing with something that is fundamentally human because all symbols of the divine are needed if we're even to talk about the divine. And yet the symbols are greater than we can conceive and they are not the real thing. But history of religion suggests that symbols will remain. They will change, however, from generation to generation. It is also very possible for what constitutes true idolatry to occur, that people begin to mistake the symbol, the stone, the tree, the doctrine, the book, the experience, for the thing itself. And as Paul Tillich once said, idolatry is to make ultimate that which is earthy and human, so that there is nothing perfect that is earthy or human, nothing. There is no perfect creed, no perfect man, no perfect book, no perfect experience like being born again, no perfect religious expression or denomination. The moment that you make perfect any one of these symbols of the divine, that's when you engage in idolatry, and that's when you begin to worship the symbol instead of that about which the symbol is or to which the symbol points. But at any rate, this began in this period, this desperate, agonizing unhappiness with diverse or foreign expressions, and that fed its way into the history of the human experience, sometimes beautifully, often tragically, and sometimes very, very negatively. As, for example, when Pizarro conquered Peru, took some of the most beautiful artwork in the history of the human experience, so we are inclined to believe, because it was made of gold, and instead of taking it back, he declared that these were idols of foreign gods. He melted these magnificent works of art down and took it back simply as gold bars to Spain. A rather tragic but consequential illustration of how biblical ideas can be overused, misused, or abused. Well, at any rate, how was the land of Canaan occupied? By gradual occupation, confederation of one tribe with another, internal revolt of some of the peoples in the cities. It was, in some respects, both sudden and gradual. It was, in some respects, both military and cultural. But it probably took place not over a period of few years or one lifetime or one generation, but probably the Hebrew occupation of the Holy Land took 300 to 400 years to be really completed. Now, the other book that is a kind of a twin to Joshua is Judges. The word Judges is a bit misleading for moderns, particularly modern Americans. We image the word judge as reflecting or symbolizing a person who sets in judgment upon other persons in some kind of a legal confrontation. And these tribal leaders who are called judges, and after which the book takes its name, Judges, did indeed perform that function. But what they really were tribal sheikhs or chieftains, one of whose function is to render judgment. And because the Jewish people by now, or the Hebrew people by now, were so much rooted in the concept of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, the law, ritual purity, and so forth, their role was considerably that of a judge. As a tribal sheikh or a chieftain, they stood in judgment upon abiding by this rule or breaking this rule, or who owns this piece of land or whose property is this, and that type of thing. But the book of Judges is about a few remarkable figures, tribal sheikhs or chieftains, judges, and it tells about the summary conquest of Canaan. And then there are these narrative stories of these judges and about how a judge would arise, or a tribal sheikh would arise, for his or her period of history. And there are some hers in this. Deborah is one of them. It's really extraordinary to discuss what was happening at this period of history, because these are old hero stories. The stories of the judges, or these tribal sheikhs or chieftains, are hero stories. And in many ways, at several very key points, guess who plays a primary role? Women. Deborah, for example, is one of the best illustrations of this. But it's a time of no central government, loose tribal confederation. The land is not fully occupied, but they are intermixing with foreign people with a different religious perspective, and in which they are fiercely defending their point of view. Once again, as mentioned in an earlier one of our segments, here in Judges, these old hero stories, you begin to see the difference between what a hero is and what a hero is often imaged as being but is not. We tend to think of heroes as being good people. Well, heroes produce good results, but they are not always good people. David, you remember, was a great hero who killed a man in order to steal his wife, who committed adultery, who went about doing all kinds of bizarre and irregular things, who fought against his own people before he became the king of his people. He was at the Battle of Gilboa, in which his predecessor, the first king of the Jewish people, namely Saul, was fighting the battle that would bring about his death. David, who would succeed Saul at that very moment, was a commanding general in the army of the enemy. So David is not a good person. He's a traitor. He's a whole lot of things that are very awkward in memory. But what he was and what he gave his people, he was a man of hope who gave his people hope. And that's what heroic leadership is about. Not giving goodness, but giving hope. Benjamin Franklin. There are lots of wonderful stories about Benjamin Franklin that don't fit the pattern of goody two-shoes. But he's a founding father. We celebrate him, and we ought to celebrate him. He gave us hope. Martin Luther King, Martin Luther himself, Michelangelo, King David, all of these are what we call hero figures, as were many of the judges in the biblical story or the biblical book of Judges. But the reason for their heroic dimension was that they gave people hope. Well, we come now to an age of transition, which is told in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, primarily. An age of transition from a loose tribal confederation, nomadic tribes, mostly in the hill country of what we now variously call Palestine, the Holy Land, Israel. We go from a period when we have independent tribes to a loose confederation of tribes, and then finally the age of transition. How did it occur? Well, we don't know exactly how it occurred, but the biblical story tells it as follows. They did have one high priest named Samuel, and presumably the loose confederation was held together under Samuel's charismatic, dynamic, energetic leadership. But the people looked about them at the peoples with whom they were fighting, the enemy, the other kinds of tribes, the city-states and so forth, and saw that most, if not all, of the surrounding peoples to themselves had kings. And so, as the story goes in the biblical narrative, they go to Samuel the high priest and say, "Give us a king." Samuel warns against this by saying, "If I give you a king, he will tax you, create a bureaucracy and a standing army, and you won't like this at all," which has been, of course, the history of governments. But nonetheless, they finally persuade him to do so, and in the process, he anoints, and that's where the word Messiah comes from, the anointing of the king. The king is always an anointed one, and that's all the word Messiah means, the anointed one. The kings were originally all called that. He anoints Saul to be the king of the Hebrew peoples. In doing so, Saul becomes a tragic transitional figure. Most transitional figures are tragic. When you have a great leader and he leaves the scene suddenly, you often have a transitional figure, somebody that has to kind of hold things together in between, but goes down the tube in the process. And that's what poor Saul was. Saul never could quite do anything right. In fact, the image in the Bible is that he has a mental illness and that he has a practicing resident psychiatrist in the form of a young man who plays a musical instrument, David. And that when Saul went into his manic, depressive, psychotic episodes, if that's what they were, it was David who played for him this beautiful music on the lyre, the harp, or whatever we would call this instrument in that period of history, and helps him recover his sanity, as it were. But that's this extraordinary transitional figure. Now, you read about this in 1 and 2 Samuel in the Hebrew Scriptures. The Samuel stories are in the first seven chapters of 1 Samuel. The Samuel and Saul stories about the anointing of the first king is still in 1 Samuel 8 through 15. And then the Saul and David story begins to spill out in 1 Samuel 16 through 31. These are loosely written stories, unquestionably, from diverse sources. David is a remarkable figure. Samuel is a priestly figure. Saul is a leader of a tribal confederation who doesn't have the moral strength, the charismatic personality, or the administrative skills to become a king, but tries to anyway, fails rather tragically, and is always viewed in the biblical narrative as a tragic figure. David, though he was fighting in the enemy's camp the day Saul was killed, and though he had been Saul's aid and comfort in his younger years, they had a falling out in which more and more Saul became envious of, jealous of, suspicious of David. And after that falling out, this is when David went and joined the enemy armies, a really traitorous act. But at any rate, with the death of Saul at the Battle of Gilboa, immediately then, David left the enemy's armies, came over and said, "Hey, I'll be your king." And of course, the story is told in a much more organized, disciplined, and presumably divinely ordained pattern than that. But this is what happens, and David does become king. As little as Saul's charisma may have existed, David must have been an extraordinarily charismatic figure. He began the creation of a nation. Now, we would not quite view the Hebrew peoples at this time as a nation, as we will do so many, many, many years later. But with David comes the beginning of real nationhood for Israel. And eventually, with his son Solomon, that nationhood will be frozen into the form of a nation, though rather tragically. This story is told, most of this story is told in 1 and 2 Kings with the accession and reign of Solomon after David. Now, David is an extraordinary figure, and let me just say one or two things about David, but you need to read the story for yourself. Obviously, he was charismatic. Obviously, he understood the psychology of people. One illustration being when they were encamped in battle. His hometown was Bethlehem. They were encamped above or near Bethlehem. And he said to one of his, I'm telling the story very loosely, but he said to one of his lieutenants how much he would like once again to drink the sweet waters of Bethlehem. So this lieutenant, devoted to this charismatic leader figure, David, by night stole down into Bethlehem, got some of the waters of Bethlehem, and brought them back to David. David, however, in an act that would have to be celebrated as an extreme illustration of soldierly psychology, held up the water, and now I'm telling the story in my way, but held up the water and said, though I would like to drink this water from my beloved Bethlehem, if all my troops cannot drink the water from Bethlehem, neither will I. And he poured it out on the ground. Well, you can imagine how the troops felt about the general at this point. They would have died for him happily, and of course, many of them did. David was this kind of charismatic leader. He did not form a standing bureaucracy, as will happen later under his son Solomon. He operated not so much by bureaucracy as by adhocracy. He put together leaders, groups, communities to solve problems as they came along, but didn't freeze it into the kind of bureaucratic form that his son Solomon would do. So 1 and 2 Kings covers the accession and the reign of Solomon, and then goes into the kings of the divided monarchy. When Solomon came to the throne, we have in Solomon a bureaucratic figure. We have in Solomon one who is not really essentially loyal to the faith of his own peoples. Every time he marries a foreign wife, and he married many, as one student in a recent examination in a biblical quiz at the high school level said, Solomon had 500 wives and 500 porcupines. Now, we think he meant concubines, but whatever, Solomon was loaded with lady friends, and every time he married one of them, he would build some kind of a religious environment, altar, building, for them to worship their God in the holy city of Jerusalem. What this means is that Solomon was setting himself against the tradition of there is only one God for the Jewish people. He was setting himself against the tradition of the priests who were then drawing the religion into sharper frames, and he was certainly setting himself against the Mosaic tradition, you shall have no other gods before me. So during his period of time, he did, however, build a temple that had really been planned by David, and he built himself a mansion or home that apparently was larger than the temple. And in doing so, he had to have many cedars from Lebanon, and in the process, he gave away part of his northern province to those of the north in order to get the cedars and other building materials he needed. This would be rather like the President of the United States deciding that we need oil from Mexico. Mexico does have a large reserve of oil, so we're going to give Mexico the state of Arizona and Southern California, because after all, these were once somewhat stolen from Mexico anyway. So we'll just give them back. Now, you may have some picture in that of how the people of Arizona and Southern California would feel about the sitting president at that particular juncture in history, which is exactly how the Hebrew peoples must have felt, or many of them, about Solomon. When Solomon, celebrated for his wisdom, died, the kingdom was broken in half or split forever until modern times, until our lifetime now. The 10 tribes of the north, or the tribes of the north, really more than 10, if you count the Levites out of the picture, but the 10 tribes of the north broke away from the one tribe of the south, which was Solomon's tribe and David's tribe, the tribe of Judah. And from that day forward, after the death of Solomon, the southern kingdom was occupied by, the throne was occupied by persons of Judean ancestry, or the posterity of the Judeans. And the northern tribes, the 10 tribes of the north, the one remaining time being the Levites, which had no land area, the tribes of the north were separated politically forever from the tribe of the south. It became in the north Israel, and in the south they began to be called Judea. And so now you have two nations, one presumed people with one presumed religious expression. Thereafter, the kings of the south are pretty stable. The kings of the north are rather unstable. And the kings of Israel are a little less disciplined about the idea of the temple. They build local shrines, but in the south, in Judea, only the temple is of importance. As the biblical story tells it, Judea, in the south, had only two kings and two good kings in its entire history. And those kings were Hezekiah and Josiah, to whom we alluded earlier. David remains an ideal, however, in some sense, for both the north and the south. Once again, not for his goodness, but for his hope. In this period, comes out of this period, Elijah and Elisha. And a few things must be said about these two as part of the process. But before doing so, we need to pause briefly and ask, why, if the kingdom broke up so violently, so tragically, and so permanently under Solomon, is he noted as the wise person he presumably was purported to be? Most scholars feel, and I would take this point of view, that the wisdom motif attached to Solomon grows up from several sources, but predominantly from the fact that Solomon opened up the world of the Hebrew peoples to the wider world around them, as under David had not occurred, and under Samuel and the confederated tribes assuredly had not occurred. By that I mean, Solomon began to see in other people's values, ideas, and he began collecting proverbs, statements of wisdom about how to live this life that he garnered or gathered from all kinds of sources. The book of Proverbs in the Hebrew scriptures is attributed to Solomon. Is he the proper author of the book of Proverbs? Well, we can't really say so, though we are inclined to the view that the gathering of a group of proverbs probably did occur during Solomon's reign. We do know that he married all these foreign wives and brought in all these foreign influences, and doubtless with them came these various wisdom traditions, and perhaps that is indeed the origin of that particular understanding of Solomon. But after that, the whole idea of wisdom begins to be a competing concept to that of cult. To be cultic is to be exclusive. To be wisdom-oriented is to be inclusive. To be cultic is to have a pattern of behavior that sharply creates boundaries as between you and other people. To be oriented toward wisdom tends to break down boundaries and invite in other points of view. Cultic patterns of thought tend to be very turned in upon themselves. Wisdom patterns of thought tend to be turned out toward others. And in consequence of this, if Solomon is the origin of many of these wisdom traditions, there's something very worthwhile to be said about this, notwithstanding his incompetence as an administrator and his obvious arrogance as a political leader in giving away land and building a huge mansion for himself and so forth. But we do think the beginnings of wisdom thought can be traced back to Solomon. Thereafter, his name will be attached to other documents. It will be attached, as already suggested, to Proverbs. It'll also be attached to other sayings of that period, and his name eventually will be attached to an erotic love poem that just barely squeaked into the canonical Hebrew scriptures called the Song of Solomon, presumably a kind of a drama about Solomon that simply cannot be described in any other terms than erotic. In 90 of this common era, when the Hebrew scriptures were canonized, it's rather interesting because several books went through a fierce bit of argumentation by the rabbis who were setting as the authorities for canonization. One of these books was the Song of Solomon because of its highly erotic temperament. But finally, the rabbis agreed that it had been popular because it had been popular for such a long period of time, because it bore the name of Solomon, and because it had been it had been interpreted as not describing an erotic, physiological relationship between a man and a woman, but the love that God held for Israel, they decided that they could include it within canonical literature. That's what Christian scholars or theologians or biblical interpreters did ever since. They began to describe it a little differently than the Jewish scholars. They too kept it in their canonical Bible, but they decided this was an allegory about the love of Christ for his church, not an erotic bit of literature of the love of a man for a woman. So both our Hebrew ancestors and our Christian ancestors decided they should keep the Song of Solomon, not only because it bears the name of Solomon or because it's such dangerous, erotic information, but because it describes something profoundly spiritual. Now, whether the original author of the Song of Solomon, who in my opinion could not possibly have been Solomon, have had in mind the love of God for Israel or the love of Jesus for his church is beyond my reckonings, but that's how they dealt with an otherwise very controversial document. A similar document was the story of Esther in the Hebrew scriptures, which we'll allude to much later, but in this context perhaps should allude to now. Esther is the story that justifies one of the great festivals, Purim, of the Hebrew peoples or the Jewish peoples. But in the book of Esther, it's a story about anti-Semitism, about a Jewish woman married to a Gentile king, Esther, Queen Esther, Hadassah. It's a wonderful, wonderful story, but nowhere in the book of Esther is God ever mentioned. God is not a character in the book of Esther, not even, and least of all, a leading character. No prayer is mentioned in Esther. There just is no religious content in that sense to the book of Esther at all. It's a book pure and simple, secular in core, and anti-Semitic. It's about anti-Semitism and about Haman, you remember, hanging as high as Haman and so forth. Well, in consequence of this, the rabbis in the Council of 90 of this common era at Jamnia that canonized the Hebrew scriptures, they wrestled fiercely with the book of Esther because it had God nowhere, prayer nowhere, and so forth, and many felt it ought to be excluded. But finally, because of its popularity and the wonderful festival associated with it, they included it, kept it within canonical literature. This is additionally interesting because of the way the biblical literature is put together, and that's the reason I tell this story, because until very recently, not even a hint of the book of Esther was found amongst the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls of the sect of the Essenes. We do think now that a couple of fragments have been found that may be or probably are from the book of Esther. But its paucity, or almost non-existence, or perhaps non-existence, amongst the literature of the sect, this Dead Sea sect that we call the Essenes, tells us one very interesting thing about how the biblical literature became canonical or official. It says that for a long period of time, certain books were very popular that ultimately made it into the Bible. Certain other books were not popular, and certain books that weren't popular at all never made it into the biblical tradition. And it would appear that the sect of the Essenes along the edge of the Dead Sea simply did not understand the book of Esther to be canonical or good official religious literature, notwithstanding the particular festival that it brought about its celebration. Well, back to the period of Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles. To go briefly to Chronicles, and the book has that title for the reason, largely, that it has genealogical listings from Adam to Saul. It has reigns of the kings of Judah, lists them. It talks about the reign of David, especially provisions for worship, and the reign of Solomon, especially the building of the temple. First and Second Chronicles probably is one continuous work and likely was written by Ezra and Nehemiah. Therefore, though it describes an historical period several centuries earlier, was produced immediately in the aftermath of the Babylonian captivity. Now, we're going to talk about Ezra and Nehemiah in the next session in a little more detail because of its enormous impact upon subsequent history as well as upon the biblical literature. But the central thing that is important about the fact that this was written during the period of Ezra and Nehemiah and likely constitutes a single document, that First and Second Chronicles, Ezra and Nehemiah, probably at one time was a single document that has been separated into these various components, is the fact that this begins to define boundaries in a fierce way that would have interesting and sometimes tragic and difficult consequences for the Hebrew, subsequently the Jewish people. In this regard, and we'll talk about this in the next session in more detail, but after the Babylonian captivity, two or three things were discovered. We have not yet gotten to the period of the great literary prophets. That will become before Ezra and Nehemiah, so we're skipping beyond them for the moment. The great biblical prophets were very cultic. They were not wisdom teachers, but they were very wise men. The biblical prophets, being cultic, were in the process of defining boundaries. Who are we and who are they? And that's a way of saying we have our cultic characteristics, they have theirs, and we must not mix them together. But interestingly, with the coming of the Babylonian captivity, one prophet, a very great man named Jeremiah, who gave us the phrase New Testament or New Covenant, way back 5 centuries before the beginnings of the so-called New Testament or New Covenant, Jeremiah proposed to the captives in Babylon that they ought to settle down, they ought to seek the welfare of the city where they were, they ought to continue to marry and be married, they ought to have children and grandchildren, because in seeking the welfare of the city where they find themselves, Babylon, they will better find their own well-being and welfare. This was Jeremiah's view. Others did not have this view. There were those that would have been of a more terrorist mentality, that would have fought against the conqueror and so forth. But this accommodationist attitude has been an interesting aspect of the Jewish experience ever since. As Jeremiah advocated a form of social assimilation, so many Jews through history have advocated social assimilation, while other Jews had advocated exactly the opposite, very much contrary to the thoughts of Jeremiah, that we ought to be separated, we ought to be different, we ought to maintain that difference in clothing, in dress, in wearing a hat, in the way we wear our hair in some of the cultic groups. So you have a struggle here, once again, as Samuel and David were cultic, and Solomon was less cultic, more open to other traditions. So Jeremiah was cultic, but he was open to the fact that you ought to live where you are, accommodate to it, and allow for a certain amount of assimilationism. However, when, therefore, the Babylonian captivity ended, due to the good offices of one of the great figures in human history, Cyrus, and when he's called Cyrus the Great of Persia, he really was Cyrus the Great. It was called Iran then, as it's called Iran now, but the Greeks called it Persia, so we ended up with an improper description for the land of Iran. But Cyrus had a policy of extraordinary humaneness in which he allowed all peoples who had been displaced because of earlier wars, and this obviously included amongst them the Hebrew peoples, all peoples who had been displaced because of earlier wars, Cyrus allowed them to return to their homelands. He allowed them the practice of their religion. They did not have to adopt his religion, which of course was the religion of Zoroaster, or what we call Zoroastrianism. And it's at this time that all kinds of dramatic changes occurred with the Hebrew peoples. Once again, I'm ahead of the story because of it relating to this part of the story of First and Second Chronicles and Ezra and Nehemiah. This created all kinds of curious changes in the Hebrew tradition. Before the Hebrews encountered Zoroastrian religion, because of the very humane policies of Persia, they had no devil in the sense of being an opposing figure to God. They had a Satan, or Satans, many of them, Satan, But the Satan, or Satan, was always one of God's ministering angels whose role was to stand in your way and keep you from doing stupid things that will be for your own destruction. For example, you know the story of Balaam and his ass, in which the Satan stands before the ass, and the ass sees this angelic figure and stops in his tracks, as is God's intent. Whereas Balaam cannot see the Satan or the Satan and doesn't want to stop in his tracks. And many of you know the resolution of that particularly wonderful story. You ought to read it right from the original material. But the point is, at that period in history, there was no Satan or devil opposing God. They were ministering angels. After the encounter with the religion of Persia, with its fierce dualism, light and dark, Ahriman the god, and Ahura Mazda the god, and Ahriman the devil-like figure, light and dark, from which we get the Mazda light globe. After that period, two things swept into the history of the Hebrew people: a fierce dualism, light and dark, good and bad, righteous and unrighteous, which, for example, as was pointed out in this first particular, the first lecture of this series, as was pointed out in Genesis, there really wasn't this fierce separation between good guys and bad guys. They're just the other guys. But now, after encountering Zoroastrianism, we get the good guy, bad guy motif. We get the light and dark motif, darkness motif. We get the devil as against God and God against the devil. A whole new shaping of thought occurs within the life of the Hebrew people. And one of the things that occurs also out of this, particularly with the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, to which we'll allude later along these terms, Ezra and Nehemiah says, we must end all intermarriage. And therefore, if you have come back from Babylon to resettle the shattered and broken land, Holy Land, as a result of most of the leaders being transported over to Babylon as captives, if you've come back from Babylon and brought with you a foreign wife whom you may have married, perhaps partly in response to Jeremiah's invitation to settle down and seek the welfare of that city, if you'd married a foreign woman and had children by her, you are to divorce her, send her and these half-breed children back to Babylon, now marry a good Jewish girl and have Jewish children. In other words, out of this period, first of all represented in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, we're getting history interpreted, Ezra and Nehemiah, out of this period comes a fierce separation of between us and them, between good and bad, good guys and bad guys, sharp boundaries being defined, and the Hebrew religion is now moving toward a fierce kind of exclusivism, which had already been nascent in the beginnings of Exodus, for example, in the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other gods before me. But now this is being frozen into the most fierce of expressions, in consequence of which we have the boundaries that exist to this day amongst the Jew, with the Jewish people in this regard and in many others. Although today, deriving from the Pharisees, you have three expressions of Judaism in the Orthodox, the conservative, and the reform point of view, with the Orthodox being fiercely and extremely boundary building, the conservatives being far less so, but practicing the traditions more carefully, and reform Jews being those who are far more open. They're the Jeremiah group, if I may put this in a rather awkward way, because I am not Jewish myself, and I don't pretend to speak for them. At any rate, as a result of this period, this fierce development of boundaries developed. Now, what else may be spoken of this period of transition? What we're dealing with here is a transition politically, economically, and religiously that will affect all the later development of the life of the Hebrew peoples and of their great literature that we have in what we call the Hebrew Scriptures. The separation will occur in respect of all kinds of things. It will occur in respect to food. It will occur in respect to dress. It will occur in respect to the space we're allowed to occupy. Eventually, it will produce attitudes that will be counter-reflected in Europeans of Gentile persuasion who will force Jews into ghetto-like environments. And this all comes out of this particular period of history. Now, a few other brief comments before wrapping up this section. Let me talk just briefly about some of these earlier figures called the judges, because they're the hero figures that introduce this. Othniel is one. He talks about apostasy, and this has to do, once again, with defining boundaries. Othniel is a conqueror. He's a military hero. He wants to create divisions between him and the foreign peoples around him. Ehud comes along in Judges 3. He has a foe east of Jordan called the Moabites. He conquers a leaderless enemy. Shamgar comes along. And then the great Deborah comes along. The Canaanites in the north were their foes, King Jabin and General Sisera. She commissions a man by the name of Barak to lead the troops, who does so. But the real hero of this story is Jael, a Canaanite woman who murders the great general of their enemy, the Canaanites in the north, General Sisera. And the Song of Deborah is one of the early poems or songs in the Hebrew scriptures found in the fifth chapter of Judges. The only reason I bring this up, having wrapped this whole period together, is to say that you're going through between the Judges and finally Ezra and Nehemiah with the prophets in between, which we haven't gotten to yet. You're going through a period of immense transition from tribal life to confederated tribal life to a loose confederation in a kind of nationhood to nationhood, then the shattering of nationhood, and the need for the Hebrew peoples to try to understand this whole complicated period and give it meaning. That's what these particular groupings of books are really about. Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, eventually Ezra and Nehemiah, are about this terrible period of transition when the Hebrew peoples are trying to understand what's happened to them, what they want to have happen to them, how they can define their life and shape it to be what they think it ought to be. You know some of the other heroic figures from this period, Samson, of course, Gideon. These are all names that are meant to celebrate certain aspects of heroism. But in the end, the whole shaping of this story still says the leading character in the story is God, Yahweh. And the rest of us are all players in the drama, but we are playing out the drama and must always remember who the lead character is and must never confuse the actors with the primary actor, who is God himself.